From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I'm from Milpitas.
Union City.
Mission Bay.
I do not know where I'm from.
Bernal Heights.
And I'm from the Sunset.
Coming up, we'll continue our series of community reactions to police shootings of people of color in the United States.
Going into work didn't even seem like an option, you know. I really felt completely terrorized.
Then a gardener brings the flavors of his native Ethiopia to the Bay Area.
I'm fortunate enough that I can say I have two countries, but there's also a responsibility that comes with that.
And we'll go inside one of San Francisco's largest historic buildings to learn how it has survived for over a century.
But like I said, a majority of the people come for the edginess. The majority of the people come because they want the shock factor.
Grappling with the past and the present today on Cross Currents. Recent data from the San Francisco Police Department shows that officers use force, physically control, and pull out their guns on black people more than people of any other race, even though black men and women only account for 6% of the city's population. Stats like those prompted us to partner with the East Bay Express this week on a series of commentaries from Bay Area residents about police-community relations. Today we'll hear from Faiza Farah, a digital media startup founder who felt especially trapped by last month's shootings of Philando Castile and Alton Sterling.
Going into work didn't even seem like an option, you know. I really felt completely terrorized because the fear was like in my bones. And everyone I would talk to, all of my friends, all of the black folks that were my friends, had the same experience. Every single time I have any interaction with the police, if I see a police car parked or if I'm driving, I have instant panic, instant fear. Like if I'm in the car with a black male, there's always that kind of unspoken thing we have to do and say, whatever we have to do and say to survive. You spend a lot of time trying to prove your humanity to people, and it is distracting. So what would you do? And I, when I say this, I speak directly to black people. What would you do if you weren't having to affirm your humanity all of the time? What kind of art would you make? What would you study? What would you pursue? How would you move through the world? What's at stake? By Faiza Farah. Rage. Do not despair, brothers and sisters. Terrorism thrives on infecting our hearts and minds with immobilizing fear. Do not give in. We thought once police officers wore body cameras, killings would stop. Dontre Hamilton. We thought if we told our children to wear hoodies, they would be safe. Eric Gardner. We thought hashtags, we can't let them forget our names. John Crawford III. We took it to the streets. Michael Brown Jr. Started a movement. Tanisha Anderson, wrote songs, created art, shared our despair on social media, Tamir Rice. And now, what is there left to do? Sandra Bland. Our freedom can't wait, not one more hour, not one more minute, not one more second. White supremacy is a disease that asphyxiates the host slower than the ones that come to contact with it. We are out of time. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. What's at stake? Our humanity.
That was Faiza Farah, one of the Bay Area residents who wrote into the East Bay Express in response to ongoing police violence against people of color. The piece was produced by KALW's Justine Lee and Lucy King. We'll have another perspective tomorrow. Do you have thoughts to share about racial justice? Call us at 415-264-7106 and record them in a message. That's 415-264-7106 to join our conversation about racial justice. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Veritas et utilitas. Truth and service. Those words could represent what we want from our justice system. They're also the motto for Howard, the historically black university located in Washington, D.C. Today is orientation day for new students, and many have traveled nearly 3,000 miles to be there. Those are kids coming from the San Francisco Bay Area. Last weekend, the Howard University Alumni Club of the Bay Area hosted a new student send-off to give families tips on what to expect from the new experience. KALW's Chris Hambrick is an alum, and she went to the event to hear how students and their parents expect to handle the distance and the new journey.
New student Erin Monroe is here with her dad, Derek.
This is not my first child that went off to school, but my daughter Erin, my baby girl, is going across the country. First time for me.
What are you doing specifically to prepare for her absence?
Wow, trying to make sure I get busy. She's a spark plug of the family, so her not being there is going to be a little weird, so trying to stay busy.
Erin says that being away from her parents will take some getting used to, but they've already established a routine for staying connected.
Me and my dad text just about every day, like, you know, about my whereabouts and stuff, but so I do plan to FaceTime them every Sunday. That's my plan.
What are you most looking forward to at Howard?
The culture. Like, where I live now, it's predominantly white, and the school I went to, my high school, wasn't white, but it just, there weren't as many people that looked like me, so I think I'm excited to experience that different culture.
Gwendolyn Bridges had a hard time adjusting when her daughter Jasmine Hammonds first went away to Howard.
Do you remember what that first week was like?
It was okay. It was okay leaving the airport. I wasn't one of those teary moms or anything like that, that, oh, my baby is gone, because she's been away from me before as well, so it wasn't that bad. But I remember as time went on, I had just gotten this home, and it was kind of big, and I was in it all by myself. I just started to feel like lonely, maybe even depressed, I don't know, but it just started to kick in slowly, you know, that I realized how much I was missing her. But at the same time, this other voice was saying how proud I was of her. And so with that being said, I had to always remember, I have to keep a balance, you know, even though I'm missing her, I'm proud that she is taking on this journey.
That was in 2006. Today, Jasmine is a graduate of Howard University and the president of the Howard University Alumni Club of the San Francisco Bay Area. She remembers her anticipation as a freshman.
I was excited. I was excited to be far and to be kind of like trying to figure it out on my own. So that was like thrilling to me.
And as far as staying in touch with mom?
So I talked to her like every day, because I would like tell her little stories of things that were happening around school, because that's just what I was accustomed to. So one random night, later in like that fall semester, I didn't call because I didn't have anything to talk about. I was like, well, I don't have to call her today because I just don't have anything to talk about. Like, it wasn't first on my mind. And then I get a call from her and I'm like, is something wrong? She was like, well, no, I'm just sitting here. I run my bath water. I'm trying to get in the bath, but you still haven't called yet. And I didn't realize that that was the connection for her, that she enjoyed me calling every day because that still kept her connected. But that's kind of how we were able to start separating.
That's what this day is about, creating a binding unit to fall back on for support. The alumni group meetup helps build a network of parents facing the same transition. New students walk away with a ready network of schoolmates from California while on campus, and the knowledge that a team of alumni and family members are pulling for them at home. In Oakland, I'm Chris Hambrick for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. The subject of our next story knows what it's like to leave home. His name is Menker Tamrat, and he's a farmer in the East Bay community of Sinol. Menker's garden and farm are a connection to his childhood home in Ethiopia. For over 20 years, he's grown Ethiopian vegetables and herbs he couldn't find anywhere else in the bay. KALW's Meredith Hadanat brings us his story.
Menker Tamrat meets me at the edge of his farm and leads me down a row of bright green pepper plants to a shady arbor and back. He points out peppers along the way.
Then you go to the Berbera peppers. It's bigger, it's longer, it's more like a little bit bigger than a jalapeno, more pointed and curved, and it's probably slightly milder than the jalapeno.
The rows and rows of peppers are all green now, but soon they'll ripen to a vibrant red. Then Menker will dry them, crush them, and make them into spice blends essential to Ethiopian cuisine.
Imagine, I mean, this just there's the Berbere, the chili first, and then 12 or 11 plus additions of seasonings and spices and herbs. So it's a sum of all these different things.
Menker wasn't always a farmer. He grew up in the countryside of Ethiopia in the 60s. He watched farmers working in the fields and then selling their vegetables at the market.
Who did the cooking at home?
Well, that was my mother's, or whoever helped her, because men don't really go into cooking. I don't think my father set foot in the kitchen just to say hi from the door and walk away.
Then in the early 80s, Menker came to the Bay Area, got his MBA, and started a career in tech. The food from his homeland was never far from his heart. But when he tried to recreate it with local California ingredients, something was missing.
I couldn't create the chili powder from off-the-shelf chilies. You know, it's a hit and miss. How do you know which one might be the closest?
So Menker went to Ethiopia and brought back the seeds he needed to start a garden. At his home in Fremont, he filled his yard with Ethiopian vegetables and herbs and peppers, the fresh flavors that made all the difference. As we walk through the peppers, he shows me a leaf.
This leaf called Kosaret, you can't never find it. It's not used in any other cuisine. And it's got its own strong, unusual taste, smell. And so those are the kind of things that we need fresh here.
For decades, Menker's garden was just a passion project. But when his tech company downsized in 2009, Menker took the opportunity to grow these Ethiopian flavors on a larger scale. He connected with Bayanikia Farm in Sanol, and by that summer, he had 5,000 pepper plants taking root in California soil. Now that he had a steady supply of the proper peppers, Menker pored over books and articles and recipes, searching for the perfect spice blend. But when he started mixing flavors together, he realized he was missing a major secret ingredient, the mom touch.
In Ethiopian cuisine, is like, you know, so-and-so's mom is known for her such and such, and she may have like one little secret thing that she adds in it. So you never get the same thing, you know, from two families making the same stew, it would not taste the same.
So Menker turned to his mother's friend who lived in Oakland, and he'd follow his mother-in-law around the kitchen with a notebook when she came to visit from Ethiopia.
They kind of have a sense of feel. You know, the good chefs, for example, they don't measure anything. So it's sort of that kind of culture.
Today, Menker sells his spices through his company, Timeless Harvest. His recipes are still evolving, but he's feeling pretty confident these days.
I even took some samples to a restaurant in Ethiopia, just to sort of show off, and said, "Why don't you guys taste this?" And in a specialty place where they specialize in these things, and the lady just could not believe it that I brought this from America and a man made it.
So you had two things against you.
Yeah.
After hearing Menker lovingly describe Ethiopian cuisine, I was getting pretty hungry. So he took me over to his friend's restaurant.
Now we're now at Finfine restaurant in Berkeley on Telegraph Avenue. And that's one of the restaurants I collaborate with. I supply them with some of my spices.
Finfine is tucked away in the back of a quiet courtyard. It's a little restaurant, no more than a dozen tables and a bar.
We're ready to order.
Oh, you're ready to order? Okay.
Menker orders a deep red lamb stew called wat, and lots of braised lentils and vegetables, all served on a wide platter of injera, a spongy sourdough flatbread.
It's a lot of food.
I hope you're helping me.
I am going to.
As we eat, scooping up bits of stew with our injera, Menker talks about the history of Ethiopian food. He chronicles centuries of invaders and cultural exchanges and the effects of religion and class on the cuisine. You can tell he's in his element. To him, this is a lot more than just making something delicious. Menker uses food to tap into the greater narrative about Ethiopia's place in the world. And now he's going back to where his own journey started. This season, Menker reduced his operations in California and spent half of the year in Ethiopia, where he's diving into an exciting new project. He's starting a farm that grows American and European crops for high-end restaurants in the capital, Addis Ababa.
So you started off growing Ethiopian crops here, and now you're growing like American crops in Ethiopia.
For the Western kitchen. And boy, it's just, I'm telling you, I don't know how it came together, but it's a lot of fun. Last week we made the first sale of, and of all of that, the Tuscan kale became the big hit. There was other things like Swiss chard, arugula.
And now it seems like you're being drawn more and more back to Ethiopia.
I am fortunate enough that I can say I have two countries. But there's also a responsibility that comes with that.
For Cross Currents, I'm Meredith Hodnott.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Now we'll head across the bay, from that rural garden to the urban jungle, to a century-old building in San Francisco that takes up an entire block. The National Guard Armory is a brooding brick castle at the corner of 14th and Mission in San Francisco. It was built by the military, but it's had other uses over the years. It was a movie set, it was a boxing arena, and then it was abandoned altogether. The armory found new life when the fetish porn film company Kink.com took it over in 2006. Now Kink has additional plans for the massive space. KALW's Stephen Short ventured into the bowels of the building to find out more about its future and its past.
Okay, let's get this out of the way, because it's come up every time I've mentioned that I'm going to the armory. My listeners' eyes widen and they ask, are you going to see a porn film in production?
Yeah, we do get that quite a bit, actually. And unfortunately, for most, they don't get to see it.
That's our guide today. She prefers to be called Dusty.
I'm the Tours and Workshops Coordinator here for the San Francisco Armory, which is also the home of Kink.com. It's not every day that we get to have someone come in here who really wants to focus on the history of the building.
Speaking of that history, this is San Francisco's second armory building. The first one was destroyed in the 1906 earthquake, along with so much else. This replacement on Mission Street was built not only to look impenetrable, but to be impenetrable. The exterior walls range from 8 to 12 inches thick. And since Dusty knows this place from top to bottom, we're starting in the basement, literally in the guts of the building.
So this particular room we're in is super heavily reinforced with double thick reinforced steel doors, because this was the munition storage room. In case anything went boom, it would be contained to this one room.
And you say now it's a dungeon.
Well, I think that pretty much everywhere we're going to go today is somewhat dungeony.
All right, this is a historic question. Anybody who's ever seen it knows it's a massive building. It takes up about a block. It's made out of brick. But it's in the middle of town. If it's a military installation, why was it built in the middle of town? Why wasn't it built on the water?
Well, it's funny you would ask that question, actually, because pertaining to this specific set, if you look over here to your right, my left, this piece of concrete sticking out from the wall and the ceiling here, it's actually a support for a massive artillery rifle that was once here. Of course, thankfully, we never had to use the artillery rifle.
It's easy to get disoriented down here in the semi-darkness of this vast space. There's no indication of where we're going. I'm totally dependent on Dusty. People on public tours are strongly advised to stay with the group. You don't want to wander off alone, as I'm about to find out.
We're in another room now.
Yeah, you're kind of having a little bit of a shock factor here, I'm sure. So this particular room that we're in is called the abattoir, and an abattoir in French is a slaughterhouse. So we do have some fake meat hanging here, all made in-house by our art department, so don't worry, it's vegan, right?
Dusty says this windowless space wasn't built as a meat locker.
This was originally actually horse stables, and they had some sort of air duct and airflow that would regulate it so that the horses wouldn't suffocate.
It might seem cruel putting the horses in the basement, but there was an elevator to lift them to street level, along with the field wagons that they pulled. And think about it, you'd want your horsepower in the safest location in case of attack. Plus, there was a water source down here.
Let's move on, because I want to show you so much more.
Yeah.
Let me just take off these set lights.
Some of the building's historic points have been lost, such as the swimming pool and gymnasium, attractions designed to entice men to join the National Guard. While the pool is gone, there's a big wrestling mat featuring the kink.com logo covering much of the floor where it once was.
The one that you're seeing right now is actually for one of our men's wrestling websites. And it's a man-on-man wrestling website where it's sort of like sex wrestling, basically.
When the troops were here, they may have trained in hand-to-hand combat in this space. But the men practicing here these days are the exact opposite of in uniform. That said, the public did pay to see regular man-on-man action here from the 1920s through the 40s in the form of boxing matches.
I'd say we should head up now.
Okay.
Let's head up the stairs.
Dusty has taken me up several flights of steps. It's all a bit confusing. And now we're outside two large doors.
Okay, you ready?
Okay.
Watch your step. Welcome to the drill court, the former drill court of the National Guard. So most people, they come into this space and they go, whoa. And that's because it is a huge space with a huge roof.
How huge? About 40,000 square feet huge. That's roughly the size of 35 to 40 Trader Joe's stores or one Walmart.
It's a freestanding roof, and that's why we need so many supports down in the basement, because there's no obstructions through the middle.
They didn't want those horses from the basement bumping into anything when they and the troops practiced maneuvers here. And it was a great spot to have those popular boxing matches, earning it the nickname the Madison Square Garden of the West. And that activity also earned the drill court its roof and bleachers.
And when the roof was added, it actually made the drill court the largest enclosed space in San Francisco at the time.
You may not have paid to see prize fights in this space, but it's possible you've paid to see something else that was filmed here. And I'm not talking about the current productions. Explosion scenes from Star Wars took place here.
So what's really interesting, I think more interesting about even the scenes being filmed here, is that George Lucas actually zoned this building for arts and productions related use, so that when we moved in 2006, we were able to begin filming right away because there's no distinction between his type of filming and pornography. So thank you, George Lucas, if you're listening.
Events besides film production still take place in the drill court. For example, today a San Francisco history organization, of all things, is holding a black tie dinner. The Armory, or to be more accurate, kink.com, the building's owner, also arranges other, less sedate events in this part of the building, such as plays and electronic dance music.
Absolutely, yeah. We just got permits so that we can have live music. So we've been a music venue, but it's always been DJs, basically anything other than a live band. So now we're able to do that. I'm not sure when our first show will be, but we're all very excited about that.
The City Entertainment Commission approved such activities in April. Modifications are underway to create a brand spanking new facility, one that won't require the neighbors to submit to torturously loud sounds. Doing as I'm told at the Armory in San Francisco's Mission District, I'm Stephen Short. for Cross Currents.
Thank you, Stephen. And that'll do for today's show. Our team today includes Jürgen Klemm, Leela Day, Dora Finkelstein, Angela Johnston, Olivia Henry, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rollins, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Our managing editor is Jen Cheehan. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. And by the way, John's lecturing tonight about the Latin roots of jazz at San Francisco's Museum of the African Diaspora. That begins at 7 p.m.
Supposed to know that something isn't right here. Oh, baby, baby, I should never let you go. Now you're out of sight.
If this music sounds familiar, you probably know the Britney Spears version. But this isn't Britney. This is the Cliptones from San Francisco. The Cliptones appear Sunday at Jane Warner Plaza in San Francisco's Castro District starting at 1 p.m. They're part of this year's Live in the Castro events. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.